long you're okay with. Good morning, everyone here in the Eastern Standard Time, and welcome to everyone who is watching from around the world. Thank you so much for being with us with this really wonderful and very special opportunity to have a conversation with the Chief Rabbi of South Africa, the one, the only Rabbi Dr. Warren Goldstein, so accomplished, a scholar, a Talmud Chacham, a community leader, a worldwide leader. Rabbi Goldstein, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Rabbi Goldberg. It's so wonderful to be with you. I'm an avid reader of your weekly Parsha column, which I really enjoy. And so it's so nice to meet you and see you face to face. And it's a real honor to be able to speak to you today.
Thank you. It's our honor. I want to acknowledge and thank the Brody family, who have sponsored our conversation in commemoration of the 18th Yahrzeit of Arnold Brody, who was from South Africa before they moved to America, Elizabeth, New Jersey, and ultimately here in South Florida. Rabbi Brody, one of the rabbis on our team, we thank them for that generosity and that sponsorship. Now, I know those who are listening, those who are watching, obviously know you. It's impossible to be part of the Jewish world and not know you and your creativity, your ingenuity, your leadership. But just very briefly, I'm the first chief rabbi of South Africa, actually born in South Africa, youngest person ever to be appointed to that position at the young age of 32. You studied in Yeshiva Gedolah of Johannesburg, also have Dayanus Eretz Chemda in Yerushalayim, have earned not only a college degree, but a PhD in comparing Western and Jewish law on issues of ethics and morality, and of course have published many, many more works beyond that. So Rabbi Goldstein, I don't know how you have time to do it all and get it all done. It's really extraordinary. But before we get into our conversation, I thought we should take a moment as Klal Yisrael, the Jewish world, lost two very, very different types of leaders, but really have so much more in common than that which divides them. The Jewish world lost Rav David Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha, and yesterday Shabbos ended here in America for us to find out we had lost Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Zak, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha. Do you have any reflections, any thoughts on both of them, on a relationship in your capacity as Chief Rabbi or in any private capacity?
Yes, I think I'm so glad that we're starting there because for me, the sense of the Jewish world, we depend on our rabbonim, on our leaders, to give us direction in Hashem's Torah, and to lose great Talmidei Chachamim and to lose great Torah leaders is something which is devastating. And I think that in South Africa, as Shabbos came out, I heard about both together because it was already Shabbos in South Africa. When the news of Rav David Feinstein, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha, came out. I think that Rav David Feinstein, as a Poisek Hador and one of the Gdoile HaPoiskim of our generation, gave direction for Halacha and how to express the will of Hashem in our lives. And without our Poiskim, we nothing. And I was just before I came on here, I've been watching the Leviah, the live stream of the Leviah. And one thing that came out so powerfully, which I experienced in a very small way, I met him once and asked a shaila to him, but I could just see the chesed, the empathy, the compassion, the love. And that's what everyone was talking about in the Hesbedim, was his tremendous love and compassion for people. And Halacha, it's such a powerful thing. The Torah, when the Gemara, as you know, refers to the Torah, calls Rahmana, the merciful one. It's, in other words, the expression of Torah is Rahmanas, it's compassion, it's the will of Hashem. Hashem is called Rahmana, the merciful one. And Mahurachum, Mafatarachum. So there's a sense that Halacha expresses the will of Hashem, but expresses the will of Hashem with love and compassion. And Rav David Feinstein was a Poisek Hador that loved the door and loved people and had time and chesed for everybody. Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks was a personal friend of mine, and I was so grateful to him for his kindness to me. As you know, my appointment as Chief Rabbi was announced just about 17 years ago, and he was the very first person to call and to offer me chizuk on my appointment, and then to offer me advice and mentorship as I was starting so young and trying to find my feet. And he was there for me, and that was the amazing thing, that he was a person of tremendous eloquence and could show the depth and the greatness of Torah in the most powerful, magnificent, inspiring way. And he was a person who loved people. And to me, that also is perhaps is what links these two giants that Klal of Lot. One was a great poetic and a tremendous poetic in halacha, but filled with love and compassion. And Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks was a tremendous explainer and teacher and ambassador for Torah Judaism, but also with this tremendous love and compassion and empathy. And I think that is so important, is that the greatness of the intellect is only one step of the way. From a Torah Hashkofa, the greatness of intellect has to be matched by greatness of midas and compassion and kindness. And that's when the Torah, when a person moves from the cerebral integration of Torah into an integration of personality, that is something which is absolutely awe-inspiring. And so it's an honor to be able to have a few minutes just to pay tribute to both of them, although indeed we could spend the entire time set aside for today on each one, and we would have hardly have scratched the surface. So, but thank you for that opportunity.
Absolutely. And it was so well said. I don't know how to add. First of all, you're in a position to reflect. You are the co-author with Rabbi Beryl Wine, the legacy teachings of for life from the great Lithuanian rabbis. And I happen to have loved that book. It's just one of your works. But I love that book very much. It was personally inspiring to me as a rabbi and to learn from them. And I think one of the things that emerges from there, and as you just said, a common theme for both Rav David Feinstein and Lord Jonathan Sacks, is as brilliant and as genius as they were, and some of that they were gifted from birth. They had the blessing of genetics that enabled them to have that. It was not only how hard they worked in order to actualize that potential gift intellectually, but as you described so eloquently, maybe their genius was surpassed by their humility and by their love and by their kindness. And I too, having very limited interaction with Rav David Feinstein Zatzal, but saw his humility, his modesty. Even though he was thought of as the posek of America, he didn't dress like one of the gedolim. He had a simple garb, a regular hat, and a regular suit jacket. And as was said also in the Hespedim, he preferred to be in the back of the room with the yeshiva boys than sitting in the front of the room with the other rabbis. And that's extraordinary, to have that genius and that accomplishment and to be so admired and have such awe of you from the masses, and yet maintain and preserve that humility is extraordinary. And I didn't nearly have the relationship you had with Rabbi Sacks, but we were privileged to have him in our community several times. And I had a small correspondence with him. But what I'll never forget, aside from, I too, like many of our congregants, printing out his weekly Divrei Torah and drawing inspiration, just how much they resonate for us. Several years ago, I went through somewhat of a hard time. Someone publicly, and we'll get to this maybe, the position when people are in public positions, had attacked with a total lie, attacked me, attacked our shul with a false accusation. And out of nowhere, I picked up my phone, and it was Rabbi Sacks, Lord Sacks. And he called just to offer a good word and to offer chizuk, strength, and to describe that he too had been the target of unfair accusations, and just to give strength and to give companionship to be able to get through it. And that meant more than my whole library full of his books. What they've done for me was when you see someone, when the camera's off, when the spotlight's off, when it's behind the scenes who they are, that even far surpasses the genius that the public gets to receive of them. And I think that's a very, very beautiful description, an appropriate description. So, again, as you say, we could talk about them for hours, but I want to move over. This Shabbos was the Shabbos Project, which is your brainchild, your enormous contribution, not only to South African Jewry, but to Klal Yisrael, to the world. So tell us a little bit about how the Shabbos Project came to be. What was the inspiration, the motivation? Did you really believe that it could happen or have the success that it seems to have in South Africa and around the world? And this is a obviously peculiar year for the Shabbos Project because of coronavirus. What were some of the ways that you saw the beauty of the Shabbos Project succeed despite the challenging times?
Yes, so it started in South Africa in 2013, and there was no intention at the time to launch a global project. In fact, at the time, even we announced it in South Africa, I remember announcing it in June at our Sinai Daba convention, which brings together Torah thinkers and speakers from all over the world, and thousands of people come. And almost just before that, we decided to do this and announced it. We didn't even have the branding and the logo or anything. We just knew what we wanted to call it, and we wanted to call everyone to keep on Shabbos, and we weren't sure how we were going to do it, but just jumped in that June, and that year it was Parshas Lech Lecha, and it was in October, so we just had a few months. And a lot of people even said, it's not going to succeed even in South Africa. And I remember having the discussion with my wife, and we said, look, what does succeed mean? If 10 Jews will keep Shabbos, otherwise wouldn't have. That's enough. We've got all the effort. And we were like very satisfied and happy to set that as the objective. And then it was an amazing thing. The South African Jewish community embraced it with such warmth, and 80% plus of the community embraced it. We even did surveys afterwards, and people kept Shabbos, and there was such an outpouring of love and excitement and enthusiasm that I started getting emails from all over the world, people wanting to participate. So in 2014, we opened up and said, okay, let's do a Shabbos project. Anyone who wants to participate, let me know. And then emails just came in. We put out a video, and emails just poured in from every corner of the globe. There's been this natural outpouring. Of course, it takes effort, but what has astounded me is the natural people's movement that has sprung up around the Shabbos project. And I think it is built on a natural thirst for Shabbos, because Shabbos is a mitzvah which is so compelling for today's times, the sense that people need to rebuild and to nurture their families, and the beauty that it brings, and the sense of stability and inspiration and connection. And then also people thirsting for Jewish unity, a desperate need for Jewish unity, the sense of we're so fragmented, and we only seem to come together when there's a crisis, where there's something terrible happening. And the idea of choosing Jewish unity, not because it's forced on us by our enemies or some sort of external crisis, but because we respect one another as Jews and move beyond the labels, and to embrace the concept of Klal Yisrael as an identity which defines our very essence. I think that's also deep down, people want that so badly. And the other element of it is that, and it's something that I've believed in over these years, and that is it's a people's movement. The Shabbos Project is not an organization which is top down with layers of bureaucracy and lots of regional directors and this one and that one. It's a people's movement. So we have like 6,000 volunteers spread across 1,600 cities in more than 100 countries, and they all work towards the Shabbos Project, and they have a sense of ownership. We have the parameters, we have the values of what it stands for. And, you know, we're very proud of that. It's a total immersive Shabbos experience. But we don't judge people. People come in, they take part of it, what they want. We're clear about, you know, that we believe with passion and pride that Shabbos in its fullness is the real gift. And the more diluted it is, the less gift there is. But people, you know, go on their own journey. And I think it's been those three elements, the beauty of Shabbos, the thirst for Jewish unity, and this dimension of a people's movement where everyone becomes leaders, and it's not top down, but it's really grassroots. And I think it's the combination of those elements that has given birth to this movement.
It is a movement, and it's caught on, and you deserve so much credit. Even as much as you describe it as grassroots, it needed a leader to challenge the people with it, and the people have clearly responded. How has it been different in Corona? What limitations, the inability to experience it in an ordinary fashion? How has it happened this year instead?
I think it's been very interesting in some ways. We've had the best Shabbos project we've had in many years, and I'll tell you why. Very interestingly, we lost the big events, the in-person events of Challah Beis and Havdalah concerts. We lost that. Because of the situation, what we gained was a lot of virtual events which linked people across countries. So there was a 24-hour Challah Beis where people were running across all the different time zones. So there was an international connection that's always been there, latent beneath the surface. But then, for example, instead of having a Challah Beis in Buenos Aires, the whole of South America came together in one big Challah Beis. And there was one from Arizona that went across North America. And then there was one, you know, starting from Hong Kong and New Zealand, running across all of the different time zones. So there was that element. But for me, the most profound and beautiful dimension of what Corona forced on the project was, in a certain sense, a return to its true roots, which is ultimately about the personal experience of keeping Shabbos. And Shabbos actually happens at home. And you see, all of these big unity events are important. They're about Jewish unity. They're about the inspiration. But ultimately, Shabbos doesn't happen at a Challah Beis. Shabbos happens in our homes. And the Jewish home, at the heart of the Jewish home is Shabbos. And the Jewish home is at the heart of Shabbos. So we created a lot of materials and guided people on. We made the campaign theme, Bring It Home, a real sense of saying, let's keep a full Shabbos at home and have a completely immersive experience with families. And that's part of what we're seeing now going forward is a bit of a journey to help people to deepen and extend their Shabbos experience and their growth in their Shabbos learning going forward, so that it's not just this one-off experience, although the beauty of the one-off experience is that people can taste it for themselves. See it. And I would also say this, even for people who are Shomer Shabbos in general during the year. It's not a binary experience, Shmiras Shabbos. Firstly, there's depth in terms of learning halacha, which the Chofetz Chaim writes about in his Hakdama Tichelet Gimel of Mishnah Berurah. But it also, it's about truly appreciating the gift of Shabbos and understanding that Shabbos is a declaration of the fact that Hashem is the creator of this world. And it's going back to the roots of the holiness and the sanctity of Shabbos, which even people who generally keep Shabbos during the year, it's an opportunity to refresh and to renew that.
So I love that perspective. Basically, it's the attitude that within every crisis is an opportunity. And even though there have been challenges to the Shabbos project this year, it's forced the project to adapt in ways which maybe are even new or better, or parts of it you might keep, to not only have the public, but to continue to promote the in-the-home Shabbos experience. So every crisis or challenge presents an opportunity, and it sounds like you and the Shabbos Project have embraced that. I want to ask a question about the Shabbos Project that's always I've been curious about, not in a challenging way, but you know, being on the other side here in America from the South Africa. And I want to ask the question by way of talking about your background, if it's okay. Sure. And your background as a microcosm maybe for the South African Jewry and what's happening in South Africa. I think there's 70,000 Jews approximately in South Africa.
It's now about close around 60,000 or so.
60,000. So, you know, in my experience, and our Shul Bokerton Synagogue was founded by a group of South African Jews who were not personally observant, but who identified with traditional approach to Judaism, with Orthodox Judaism. That seems to be in South Africa. The model is that even if you're not personally observant, but what you're not observant from is a halacha, Orthodox perspective on Torah, and not another denomination or perspective. So that's an advantage, so to say, that you have, an advantage of South African Jewry, that even those who are not yet ready to embrace observance or observe all of Shabbos, their familiarity with or that which they're not doing is the full version of it and not some alternative which offers options, which, you know, is a challenge that we have here in America. So I'm curious, in terms of your own background, your own upbringing, when did you get inspiration? When did you know you'd become a rabbi, let alone a chief rabbi? Are you an example of that sort of paradigm of South African Jewry and emerged to be a leader of it? And then we'll get to my question of how that relates, therefore, to the application of the Shabbos Project, the difference maybe between in South Africa and here in America.
Yes, because I want to get to that question about the difference between South Africa and America. And maybe with your permission, can I start there and then get to the personal side of it?
Absolutely.
Because I think my experience has been, and now, you know, the Shabbos Project has been an international phenomenon since 2014. So we've had a number of years of experience. And what my experience has been this, that the biggest challenge facing, I would say, English-speaking Western Jewry is, the truth is it applies right across the globe, and I found the same thing. The issue is this: do people view Judaism as something relevant, compelling, deep, intelligent, meaningful, sophisticated, adding depth to their lives? That to me is the simple question. If the answer to that question is yes, then my experience has been, and obviously I'm saying this, you know, far away in the southern tip of Africa. So, you know, I will certainly defer to the on the ground experiences that you and others have had. But my experience has been that if you provide a perspective and a picture of Judaism which is relevant, compelling, sophisticated, meaningful, all of that, people want it. They don't mind the labels. They're not interested in the labels. In fact, I'm seeing a trend in the world which, in a certain sense, is post-denominational, because it's really saying, give me something, tell me what it is, what brand it is. Just tell me, I want to know if it's relevant and compelling and will add meaning and beauty to my life, I'm in. If it won't, well, I'm switching off, not because I've rejected it for ideological reasons, but because I've too much to do in my life. I'm not getting engaged with anything that doesn't feel relevant and compelling. And so what we found paradoxically in Shabbos is this: it is the total immersive experience of Shabbos with all of the halachas that actually is the most compelling offering from the perspective of people's lives. Because if it's not the total immersive experience, then what are you offering people? A dinner? Okay, that can get a dinner anywhere. Why should they come to your dinner if they can get a dinner somewhere else? So, you know, you're offering them a nice ritual here or there, but people can find their own rituals. But Shabbos as an experience, Shabbat is an experience which is a totally immersive experience where you switch off cell phones, put away car keys, put away the screens, is radical. It's a radical disruption of modern life, but that's actually what makes it interesting.
Just to interrupt you for a moment, I guess my question, and this is the challenge here on our side, is can you create the experience of the disruption, which is not all or nothing? Can the disruption just be for Friday night, even if one is not prepared to embrace it for the 24, 25 hours of all Shabbos? And the reason I ask that question in the background, the backdrop, and again, I defer to you, your expertise and your personal experience, is my impression of many South Africans is that they'll say, my parents were Shomer Shabbat. My grandparents were Shomer Shabbat. We used to visit them and I would keep Shabbat then. So now when the chief rabbi has challenged me to do that for 24 hours once a year in my life, I'm prepared to do it. Whereas here, we sell somebody to imagine doing that for 1 hour. They have no familiarity, no experience. And of course, there are many who do remember their grandparents kept kosher in the home. But the notion of a fully embracive or immersive Shabbos experience is so foreign and so bizarre and so out of the realm of their experience, they don't relate to it. And if we did it in bite-sized chunks, said just Friday night, immerse yourself in Friday night, don't touch technology until you wake up, then we might be more successful rather than a tafasta meruba. If we try to take bite off too much, maybe we won't succeed.
But what I think is a crucial paradigm shift that has to take place is I don't believe that we, when I say we, it means educators or people coming, we should not be making decisions for other people, meaning that, and this is the key, it's all in the vocabulary. The vocabulary is, and the brand and the atmosphere of the Shabbos Project is, this is amazing, it's fun. You know, the lot of the things that we do are quite cheeky and fun and a little bit irreverent. And then we're saying, look, here it is. This is what a 25-hour experience looks like. And then we say to everyone, make your decision. We don't want to make it for you by saying, you know what, don't worry about that part of it. Just worry about this. We just put it out there. People naturally, it's a free world, so people will naturally take this piece or that piece. And we've had stories of people who just decided to come to the Chalabek, not even start with Shabbos. Never mind, let's go to a Chalabek. And then that journey of the Chalabek was so inspirational that they then decided to try out Shabbos. And then a person who takes a piece of it, and then it links. So the way that our approach is non-judgmental, open source, empowerment. Here's the knowledge. Here's the information. Here's why we think it's so wonderful. Make your decisions. You know, we're not. What I feel is an important thing is we as the Shabbos Project, we don't come to persuade people to keep Shabbos. Persuasion sets up a power dynamic. I'm persuading you, so then we're in a power struggle. Will I persuade you? Won't I persuade you? What it really is saying is Shabbos belongs to every Jew. Like why, you know, it belongs, and this is also the crucial thing. It's not that Shabbos belongs to religious Jews and that out of the goodness of our heart, we're going to share it with other Jews. No, Shabbos belongs to every Jew. It doesn't matter who you are, where you come from. It's yours. And here it is. And it's the most amazing thing. And you know, so funnily enough, in the early stages of the project, you know, who actually guided me on this was Professor Dan Ariely. You know, he's one of the top behavioral psychologists in the world, professor at Duke University. He's a secular Israeli, self-described, who moved to America. He's a very close friend of mine, and he's been advising me on the Shabbos Project and other things right from the very beginning. And you know what he said to me at the very beginning, as we were even just formulating it? He said, don't dilute this. The power is in the totality of this thing. Give people, empower people, let them taste an experience of it, which is not diluted, and put that on the table. And you know, I just actually did a webinar with him just last week. It was a webinar in Hebrew for an Israeli audience. And the Israelis, because obviously he's Israeli, and they were loving it. And he was actually, we were going through all of the incredible psychological benefits of Shabbos, which emerge from the immersive experience. But again, it's about empowerment. It's about knowledge. It's about saying, here it is. It belongs to all of us. It's yours. It's a gift. You want to take it, take it. You know, enjoy it. It's open. It's there. It's not like I'm going to package it for you and I'm going to persuade you, take this, don't take that. I'm saying, here it is. Take it. Enjoy it. It belongs to all of us. Let's celebrate it. And I think this is a crucial part of the ethos of the Shabbos Project. We see all Jews as equals. That's the vision that I've tried to put into it. We are all equals in this. And Shabbos belongs to each and every single one of us equally. And it's not like one group of Jews coming to persuade another group of Jews. It's rather saying we have this incredible heritage, this incredible mitzvah that Hashem gave us. Here it is. Let's celebrate it and just enjoy it. It's the most incredible gift in the world. Don't you want something of it? Yeah, let's
make peace. What I'm hearing you say is that we don't need to be apologetic or water it down. And that's part of its success. And I think that's extraordinary. That's part of why people admire it and admire you is – it's put out there as a challenge, and it takes courage to do that, to not be apologetic or defensive about saying this is what Shabbos in its most authentic form looks like, and come join us, embrace, be part of whatever element or however extent you want to, that we'd love to have you as part of that. Have I lost you? Did you lose me? I think we have lost Rabbi Goldstein, trying to get him back. Thank you for your patience. I don't know if the challenge is on my side or his side with the internet. Let's see. Waiting for him to come back. Oh, here he is. Okay. All right. Rabbi Goldstein, welcome back. I don't know if that's on my side or your side.
Well, with my side, the Wi-Fi went down for a second, but it's back up. So I'm sorry about that interruption.
No, don't apologize. The truth is here in South Florida, we are in the middle of a tropical storm, borderline hurricane. So I thought maybe it was on my side, but it's nothing can stop us from having this conversation, which is really very refreshing because, as I was saying, I don't know where we lost each other. I think part of your success and why I admire you and this project is how unapologetic it is, how non-defensive it is, that this is Shabbos in its most authentic form and everyone's invited to be part of it to whatever degree that you want to. I guess the challenge we have on our side, and I know that, you know, we have the family who sponsored our conversation, Brody's, Rabbi Brody's our outreach rabbi. Very few Orthodox shuls, at least in America, have a dedicated outreach rabbi. And when we talk about, and he leads our efforts, when we talk about implementing the Shabbos Project here, that's some of our debate is, if we challenge people with too much, will they take it on? If somebody reads that you have to do it or that the challenge is a 24-hour challenge, will they not even do it for an hour? Whereas if we broke it up incrementally in segments and said, try Friday night, would they be more likely to embrace it? So I definitely hear your perspective and your argument. It's very compelling.
But and also, you know what I think, and I know this is also what's exciting about what Partners in Torah is doing, and that is you know, ultimately, the Shabbos Project is a celebration of Shabbos all around the world and a celebration of Jewish unity. What we're looking now is to deepen Shabbos journeys, meaning that people need to go on a journey of understanding and appreciating. And that journey is something that people need to take time over to really internalize and to appreciate and that happens with Torah learning. That's why I'm very excited, you know, about what Partners in Torah is doing in honor of the Shabbos Project. They're launching a special 3-part series for people to find a chavrusa and to join them in learning about Shabbos for the next 3 weeks. You know, and you can go onto the Partners in Torah the website and find the Shabbat program that's on there, which they're launching this week. following the Shabbos project. And I think that's something which is so special, because ultimately when people learn and they go on their own personal journey, there's something that comes from those personal journeys, and it's something that we want to look at broadening and deepening the experience throughout the year, that people can go on those journeys. So when Shabbos Project comes around, they will be in a different place. And I think that's something which is, which can be really special.
That's amazing. And people can look on the bottom where scrollingpartnersintorah.org/Shabbat is where you can find it. And I would certainly encourage everybody, as the Chief Rabbi did, to sign up. So let's move back to the question of your background, the state of South African Jewry, and some of the differences between what you experience and what we do. One of my dear friends here in our community, who was one of the rabbis, is still a rabbi here in South Africa, in South Florida, was one of the rabbis at our shul, Rabbi Barak Bar Chaim. So I'll never forget that when I was with him once, when we were working together on something, and we met a Jew, not part of our shul, and the Jew, in casual conversation and passing, had mentioned that they were intermarried. They're married to a Gentile, to a non-Jew. And right after the conversation, I was ready to move on, because meeting such an individual, tragically in America, is a daily activity. And Rabbi Bar Chaim was visibly shaken. And I asked him, what's the matter? And he said, I've never met somebody who's actually married out of our faith. I've never met somebody who's intermarried. He was shaken to his core. And part of why I so admire him is his level of Yiras Shamayim, his connection to heaven, and how deeply disturbed he was at the sense that somebody might have even taken that bold act. So he told me in South Africa he had never met an intermarried. Certainly there are levels of assimilation, and there are people who have yet to become observant or to return to a state of observance, but not that degree of assimilation. That's one of the differences. So maybe you could describe those differences again, go back to your upbringing, if you don't mind sharing personally your story. Is that part of the South African story? And did you see yourself becoming a rabbi and ultimately the chief rabbi at that young age?
So I think Rabbi Bar Chaim and I were chavrusos in yeshiva. I don't know if he mentioned to you. So I know him very well, and he's such a wonderful person and a dear friend from many years ago. I think, each Jewish community has got its own culture and energy. And I also think that a South African Jewry also has its own issues in terms of intermarriage. I don't, I think that it's something that we are seeing a rise, and it's something which I'm concerned about, that, needs, it's not at the levels of North America and the United States of America in particular, but, it's something that one needs to look at and find a way of, holding the Jewish people together. And I think that is important. To me, what is very beautiful about the South African Jewish ethos, and it's something, which I wrote about a little bit in that book with Rabbi Wein, the legacy that you referred to at the beginning, and thank you for your kind words about it, because that book is very meaningful to me. It reflects a lot of what I learned from my Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Israel Chaim Goldfein Zatzal, who was a Talmid Muvak Bar of Mordechai Gifter, and he came to set up a Yeshiva Gedole in Johannesburg, and he taught us, the importance of Midas Tovus, of good character, and Darchei Noam, and dealing with people with kindness and gentleness, and a Yiddishkeit which is unifying and embracing. And South African Jewry has had a culture of unity, and has had a culture also of Darchei Noam and Midas, which over the years, they say the Ponovitch Rov, that they tell the story that when he came to South Africa in the 1950s, when he was raising money for Ponovitch Yeshiva, so he being a Levak, and found a lot of the Fisher there in South Africa, it was an affinity, and he said there at the time that he saw Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky writes about an introduction to my book Rabbi Wein. He says there that he saw the Ponovitch Rov saw in South African Jewish community the Midas of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and he said that would always be, he felt that Yiddishkeit would come back because of that. And I think that what's important, I don't have sort of easy solutions for how it can be done, but I do think that there is a way of, we need to find ways of engaging with one another which are filled with that, with the Derech Eretz and the Midas Tovus. That's a very important, and you actually see it in the Gemara in Yuma, that famous Gemara, that it says, how does one from the Pasuk that the name of Hashem of heaven should be beloved through you. And the Gemara says, how do you get people to love Hashem? It's not about what you say, it's about who you are. It says that you talk nicely to people, but and with integrity, that is going to cause people to love Hashem. So the starting point in terms of that is integrity and kindness and gentleness. That is part of it. But South African Jewry has been on a remarkable journey of a lot of people returning to Torah and to mitzvahs over the decades, and a transformed community. There was a time in the late 1970s, early 1980s, where there was hardly Shomer Shabbos people in the whole of Johannesburg. And today that there are whole communities of it, and these entire communities of people who became Shomer Shabbos even though they weren't born into it, and Johannesburg Day, Baruch Hashem, and Cape Town, not to the same extent, but also is a thriving Mokum Torah Johannesburg with Kolelim and Shivas and lots of growth in Torah, but there's a sense of one Kehillah. Like, for example, my work as chief rabbi is very much dealing with all the different parts of the community, from those, who are most intensely involved in Torah and mitzvahs and learning and everything, to those who are right on the extremes and perhaps are even unaffiliated. But it's about holding that sense of kehillah, that we're one kehillah together, we're one community, and we may have different levels of observance, but we are one community, and it's also part of what I've tried to do also is to ensure that the Torah which I deal with is engaging with issues in society, because I believe Torah has a broad mission for society. So, for example, when we had a very serious violent crime problem, I got involved with a number of people to establish this organization, CAP, Community Active Protection, which now protects about 250,000 people in the city of Johannesburg, which has brought down contact crime between 80 and 90%. I was involved with the Minister of Education in drafting a Bill of Responsibilities, which is taking the Bill of Rights and turning each right into responsibility, which is part of the curriculum. So I believe that Torah has a message for society as a whole. Shabbos and learning Torah and all of these things are vitally important for Klal Yisrael. But Hashem, he looked into the Torah, created the world, the world, everything in it, everything is in the Torah. And so that is, so for example, when we had a very corrupt president, President Jacob Zuma, and he was involved in attempts to steal the entire treasury and all of the contracts and the various departments within government, there was a civil resistance movement to him. There were marches on parliament and marches on the president, and I joined those marches and wrote articles calling for his resignation, and in fact even changed the wording of the prayer for the president in our synagogues, where instead of saying to pray for the president, I said, we ask God to bless us with a president who's morally worthy of this great nation. So I got involved in some of, look, the article that you wrote, I think was very on point in this last week. The situation we were dealing with at the time was a very extreme situation of blatant and rampant corruption. It was very specific to that. But the point that I'm making is that Yiddishkeit and Torah has a very broad, because the work that I did in my PhD is to look at the issue of human rights from a Torah perspective, to say Torah has to have, and it goes back to what I said to you before, that if people see that Torah is relevant, sophisticated, deep, powerful, compelling for every aspect of life. It's what Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch once said. He said that he doesn't like Torah to be described as a religion, because religion implies something very narrow, whereas Torah is an entire way of life. It's an entire Weltanschauung, a whole world philosophy of society and the human condition, and every aspect fits into that. And I feel that that's a kind of a broad approach enables people to see the greatness of Torah, and then it opens hearts and minds to be able to look at the specifics, because it's coming from that perspective.
Chief Rabbi, you're a real Kiddush Hashem, and in this way, I think very much nobody can fill the shoes of Rabbi Lord Sachs Zatzal. We're reflecting on him this morning upon the terrible news this weekend, but very much in the same style, that you are not only the chief rabbi for the Jews, but the chief rabbi beyond, which is how he saw his role as well. And it's a reminder to all of us that Torah and Judaism were never meant just for the Jews. We have a message and a light for the entire world. And in our view, we're not trying to impose it on the others, but we also shouldn't retreat or hide it from the world, because the world now desperately needs it. You can speak to how it's needed there, and I can speak to how it's needed here, maybe more than ever, in terms of moral corruption and in terms of vacuum of leadership and in terms of the questions of the day. We should not be retreating. We should not be hiding Torah. We should be promoting and sharing. We should be out there communicating and advocating, and allow our Torah to illuminate that darkness and to share its timeless wisdom in the way that you are, which is really, really extraordinary. As a public personality, there's nothing anyone could criticize about you or your projects. But when you put yourself out there and you're a public personality, by definition, it's going to attract criticism. How do you handle that? As a chief rabbi that began at the young age of 32 years old, at 32 years old, when you were appointed chief rabbi, and people might have been critical then, and you're not the first in time. We know the story that we read on Seder night of being appointed at a young age. How do you deal with criticism personally? How do you make sure that it doesn't hold you back, or it doesn't eat away at you? How do you deal with criticism?
It's a great question. I think it's an important point for all of us. Although people in public life, as you've experienced, well, as you referred to, I wasn't aware of it, but as you referred to your experiences, and I've had, you know, many times over the last 17 years, criticism and all kinds of things. Even at the time, you know, with this thing of challenging the president publicly, there were a lot of people in the community who criticized that approach and criticized the approach of getting involved with crime fighting and all different, different kinds of things along the way. The most important thing is to realize that ultimately we are here on behalf of Hashem, and is that internal sense of the purpose of leadership in general, and as a human being and as a Jew, ultimately we are here to do good in the world and to do mitzvahs. And the measure of that is in the eyes of Hashem. Of course, we have to go out of our way in order to do things in a way that people can see transparency and that they can see accountability. V'yitzim nikiyim, to be clean transparent in the eyes of every person. But ultimately, the final measure is in the eyes of Hashem. And that to me is the sort of the place that I go to when I'm criticized. Also, it's part of realizing that leadership and the truth is, doing any good in the world by definition comes with criticism, even when it's not deserved. And there's so many examples with Moshe Rabbeinu. That famous midrash where when he left late, they criticized him. They said he's sleeping too late and he's not working hard enough, and he left his tent early. Then they said he's having problems at home, so that's why his wife threw him out the tent early. So whatever he did, he was getting criticized. And then the final thing is this: sometimes it's important to listen to that criticism, because there can be something in it. Sometimes it may even, be nasty and not constructive, and very often it can be. Sometimes there's something in it to hear and to listen. Sometimes it's pure nastiness, and then actually one's better off not listening to it at all, because it's nothing constructive. But sometimes there is constructive criticism, and I think what the key is to find objective advisors who will tell you the truth, because it's so easy to surround oneself. People don't want to tell you, And so what I've tried to do over the years is to find really smart people to be around me, people who feel comfortable to tell me when I am making mistakes, because when it's coming from, people who are just seeking to destroy, you can't hear that, because there's no bona fides in their motives. But when good people are, then there's something, and we can all make mistakes, and I think part of leadership is the humility to know that we can make mistakes, and we need to but have people around us, and that's the definition of a chaver, k'nelecha chaver, acquire for yourself a friend. In Pirkei Avos, Rabbeinu Yonah there says, a friend to do mitzvahs with, a friend to learn Torah with, and a friend to hear the criticism and to get advice. That we are too close to ourselves, so we need to find the people who can guide us and direct us and keep us on the straight and narrow.
That's a great perspective. We are we're winding down on time. I just want to ask if it's okay, two more questions. One is, Rabbi Goldstein, it seems like everything that you've touched turns to gold. You're an accomplished author, accomplished speaker. You have advanced secular degrees, a grand advanced smicha and dayanas. These projects you've begun have had extraordinary success. Is there something that you tried which was a failure? And I ask not God forbid, to embarrass. I ask because it will inspire us. Sometimes we meet or we're exposed to somebody who it seems that everything they've done, everything they touched has succeeded. And if we learn that, I once had this opportunity to have this conversation with Rabbi Sachs, and who was very quick. He burst out in laughter and told me about several failures, including his failure to publish until he turned 40 years old and then wrote a book a year after that. Is there a failure of yours that you think about or that you learn from that we would be inspired by?
You know, I would say this, there are plenty. Some of which are not good to mention on in an interview, but I will say this, that each one of these things comes with failure and setback every step of the way. In other words, like I'm saying, whatever it is, that there's so much that is going on that is within it, that being tired and not seeing. And then pushing this and trying that, I think that part of day-to-day life is about just pushing on. It's the sense of just keep moving and keep trying. And the times, I'm like one of the things that you mentioned. I'm hoping next year to start a Pirkei Avos learning project. But people who know me. Know that I've actually been working on this project for years, and a few years ago I launched it, and it didn't succeed. But I didn't, I launched it in a certain way and didn't try this and didn't try that, and then I went with my team and we reconstituted the whole thing, and we've been through so many variations of it. And please God, next year we're hoping to, to launch. I'm hoping will be, a really beautiful, learning project around Pirkei Avos, because I think Pirkei Avos it's the heart and soul of Torah values, and it's accessible to all. And it's, I think every Jew needs to learn it, and every Jew can learn it. So I'm hoping, as something to sort of accompany the Shabbos project in the years ahead will be a kind of a Pirkei Avos. But I've been up and down with that for years, and trying this and trying that, experimenting with this, experimenting with that. I think now we've got a formula which I hope will work. So we'll launch it next year. We'll see. But it's been a lot of experimentation, failure. It hasn't succeeded yet. But I believe in Pirkei Avos. So I believe there is a way to get it right, where it can become a mass-based learning project, but at the same time be true to the depth of the wisdom of Chazal. So I think each, and I found in all of these things, everything is hard work and relentless sort of coming up to obstacles and stumbling and fixing and stumbling and fixing. Even the things which appear to be successful are the result of multiple, many failures all the way through in order to get to that point.
Well, I can't wait to see it and to jump on board with it. And I have no doubt it will be a success if you're behind it. Last question, because we can't leave this conversation without talking about our beloved Israel, Medinat Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, the people of Israel. Your PhD is on human rights. You positioned yourself as a spokesperson for human rights. What's it like in South Africa defending Israel? Are there people who will attack you claiming Israel violates human rights and hold you out because you've been a spokesperson for human rights? The word apartheid is used to describe Israel by our enemies, and you know what real apartheid is. Obviously, growing up in South Africa. Tell us about what's happening right now in terms of your position as chief rabbi, defending and being the spokesperson for Israel in South Africa.
Yes, it's been a really bumpy journey because there is a tremendous amount of hostility from the South African government and the ANC, the ruling party, towards Israel, a natural affinity, away from, from Israel. And then there's this apartheid accusation. So the first thing that I've done over the years is to categorically reject the accusation that Israel is guilty of apartheid. And I've written many articles on that. If people are interested, they can get it on my website, chiefrabbi.co.za. I've set the arguments why it's not apartheid. Because one has to say, what was apartheid? What is Israel? And explain it. And, the arguments are, I believe, compelling. And I believe as the Jewish people, we have to reject that accusation because it is a defamation of the Jewish state, and it's an insult to the victims of the real apartheid. If everything is apartheid, nothing is apartheid. So it's something which I have fought for many years in the context of South Africa, and I've come to blows with many people in the media, not physical blows, but media blows, with cabinet ministers, with senior ANC officials, with judges of the Constitutional Court. Because recently I participated in a webinar with the Chief Justice of South Africa, Chief Justice Mogoeng, Kath, the editor of the Jerusalem Post, hosting and moderating a discussion between us. And Chief Justice Mogoeng came out in support of Israel. And there was a tremendous, backlash in South Africa. And I traded blows with some of the retired Constitutional Court judges. And the line of attack, and this is why it is so vicious, and the line of attack is, it's not that I disagree with you. They don't say that. They say for you to defend Israel makes you a fascist, racist, and they deny the very legitimacy of it. And that's what I've been fighting for, to say, listen, you may have a different perspective on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I disagree with it passionately, but I respect your right to disagree with me on it. But you have to grant me the right to be able to articulate a defense of Israel without being cast as a racist. And I think that to me is so important. We have to fight for the justice of the cause of the state of Israel, not just because of ethnic solidarity, but because it's the right thing. And Israel is this incredible beacon of democracy and freedom in the Middle East. And it is, properly told, and it would be the subject of a whole long of its own conversation. But a lot of the work that I've been involved in over the years has been in order to put out that case. And again, it's a certain sense one can't be apologetic about this. One has to go into that arena fearless and say, this is the truth, because we're standing up for Kiddush Hashem. It's about defending the sanctity of Hashem's name. Because people defame the Jewish state as guilty of the worst human rights violations, that is a stain on our reputation as Jews. So and if we are silent, then we're saying that accusation is true. So we have to from the rooftops to defend the state of Israel, and I think that is so important in South Africa, but also in the United States. There are voices, in Congress. And who have in recent years become more and more militant in their approach against Israel. And it's so important to enter into that debate, but to enter into the debate rationally, intellectually, with all of the arguments, and to keep the debate dignified but firm and strong, and not to give an inch. We cannot give an inch. If someone accuses Israel of something terrible, we have to rise to the defense, because otherwise it stays on the record, and that besmirches the reputation of Klal Israel, and that besmirches the reputation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this world. So we have to be there on the front lines, but intellectual, rational, arguing the case, and unrelenting in our defense of Israel.
Chief Rabbi Dr. Goldstein, I can't thank you enough for being with us today. But much more significantly, I can't thank you enough for fighting for the Jewish people, fighting for Torah, fighting for Israel, and for being a Kiddush Hashem. What you've accomplished is extraordinary, and we know there's so much more to come. People can join partnersintorah.org/Shabbat, or they can find more of your writings, chiefrabbi.co.za. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you for the gift of the Shabbat Project. Thank you for the gift that is you and all that you are doing. And we could talk for hours and hours, but please God, it's a conversation that will be continued as we go forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi Goldberg. It's been an honor to talk to you, and I look forward to your Parsha articles each week. So we'll see what you have in store next week. Thank you.
Thank you. A special thank you to the Brody family for sponsoring in memory of the 18th Yahrzeit of Arnold Brody. Arnold was a very special man, a humble and modest man, but a leader in his family and beyond. So thank you very much for that. And wishing everyone stay happy, stay healthy, stay holy. Have a wonderful day.